You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. For a weary traveller crossing the USA, not many sights are as comforting as seeing a hotel with a vacancy sign lit up. As you rest your head in your comforting bed, and sleep slowly creeps upon you, perhaps you begin to drift away, only for a strange noise or sensation to jolt you awake. Perhaps the reason that there were some vacancies is due to the spectral guests who never check out. Joining me today to dive into some haunted hotels and first-hand experiences is the marvellous Kevin Lee Nelson. He gives us the lowdown on some notable haunted hotels, his personal experiences visiting some of them, as well as looking into several hellhound stories from across the Americas, some of which were completely new to me. It's a marvellously enlightening and enthralling conversation, and I thank Kevin for his time as always. But before we get there, as always, you can support Mysteries and Monsters via patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free content, guaranteed early releases, bonus episodes, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Mastodon, Facebook, and you can also find us on LinkedIn. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, as we begin 2023, let's hit the road with Kevin Lee Nelson on the hunt for haunted hotels and hellhounds. On today's show, we delve into the rich history of folklore, cryptids and more in the company of our good friend Kevin Lee Nelson. From braving sub-zero temperatures on the hunt for the Wendigo, tracking vampirism across the USA, hunting for cryptids, or uncovering folk history, Kevin's thirst for the mysterious has continued unabated. Kevin, I'm delighted to speak to you again. How are you?
Great. It's great to be back on the show.
It's nice to get a chance to speak with, no offense to our normal conversational subjects, Kevin, but it's nice to be able to sit down and have a conversation with you about some of your passions and love, because you're someone that's had a real interest in this all your life. I know I've heard you say that when you were a young person, you were always attracted to it, and you're one of those people, you can't really say what kicked off your interest. You just seem to prefer the weird things to life than what other people of your age at that time did.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of people can maybe point to a certain life event that got them into kind of strange topics and, you know, folklore and the paranormal or what have you. But for me, it's just kind of always been there. There's not any one particular point or moment I can point to say, hey, that's when my interest was peaked. It was just kind of always there. So it's kind of in my blood, I guess.
Yeah. I read an interview that you at school, it might have been at school, Kevin, you gave a demonstration on how to conduct a seance. Is this true?
Yes. That I was in fourth grade and what we were supposed to do is show the class a demonstration.
Mm.
Yeah, we were supposed to show like how to perform something. So, you know, it was usually most kids pick something simple, like this is how you make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or, you know, this is how you tie your shoe or something like that. You know, something very simple. It was like some of the earliest kind of public speaking that you do in fourth grade. And we could pick any topic that we wanted. So I just chose how to do a seance, because to me, I just thought that was cool and I was interested in them, and my teacher approved it. So that's what I did.
So how did that go down?
I think the kids didn't know if I was serious or not, you know, a lot of giggling and things like that from what I remember, but you know, I had fun with it, you know, and, you know, just showed them what it was like to perform a seance.
That's fabulous. That's a lot. That's far more. That's the kind of thing I'd have been fascinated with, because we don't usually do that type of thing at our school. We don't do show and tell or those kind of talks at junior school here. So it's when I read that, it really made me chuckle, Kerry, because I know you've got a good sense of humor and a deep interest in this particular subject. And I thought, yeah, that just doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And I really hoped it was true.
Yep, it happens.
I think these days you're probably more well-known because of your work alongside Chad Lewis and Bat Rhodes Law, along with Noah Voss as well, in regards to digging out some cryptids. But you had a real interest in parapsychology and ghost hunting probably at the beginning of your career, Kevin, which is something that I'm very interested to see that you've still carried on that deep love of that particular subject, but perhaps you don't indulge it as much as perhaps you probably did sort of 10, 15 years ago.
I would say that's correct. I'd say in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was really into, paranormal research and, I don't want to call it ghost hunting. I mean, that's kind of had a lot of, now these days it has a lot of negative connotations, but just doing a lot of research with haunted locations and things like that. And I was really passionate about it for a number of years, but yeah, the thing is with researching the paranormal and things, there's a high level of burnout. And I think pretty much anyone that's been doing it for a long time would agree with me that, you know, you can only poke around in haunted houses so long with and getting no results and still kind of stay interested in it. And so I was basically left with the choice of, do I start to see things that really aren't there, you know, kind of like, start fooling myself, which I think some people fall into that trap. You know, they start seeing ghosts everywhere, or they start really nitpicking at EVP, kind of garbled things and start seeing voices and where there really probably aren't voices.
Mm.
So, you know, I wanted to kind of, I didn't want to fall into that trap where I just start convincing myself that I'm seeing things when I'm really not. And so I had to basically retool what my goals were. You know, was it to prove or disprove that ghosts were there? I had to move away from that. I had to just basically look at it as an experience and start collecting the stories instead of trying to prove or disprove whether a place is haunted or not. So these days, it doesn't really matter to me whether a place is truly haunted or not haunted. It's the stories that I'm mostly interested in. And even being at the locations is always fascinating too, because usually they're, you know, older buildings or historic structures or even abandoned buildings. And I'm a kind of an architecture nut too. So I just really enjoy being in some of these old buildings and just appreciating the atmosphere or the sense of gloom that some of them have. So, you know, that's kind of what I get out of it these days is I see it more as an adventure and not just as a prove or disprove kind of approach.
Hmm. I think these days it's very easy to get quite po-faced about modern ghost hunting and parapsychology, because I think the way it's portrayed these days, most people's first experience to ghost hunting or doing investigations, Kevin, is through television. And that seems to have completely gone away from what it used to be like, to this kind of all action, running around, shouting at stuff with gadgets galore pinging everywhere. And I think it's kind of taken everything away from, as you say, the thing that really got me into ghosts was some of the stories that were attached to certain properties and some of the legends and some of the older experiences. And I think it's kind of gone away from this kind of situation where we have these stories and we'd meet people and speak to them and look at it without wanting to kind of categorically prove that something was going on there. Whereas now it's all or nothing, it seems.
I would agree with that. You know, it's a lot of these shows that came about in the early 2000s, you know, like, I mean, there's just so many, you can't keep track of them now, you know, just put a bad taste in my mouth, I guess, the lack of a better way of describing it. Just because what they ended up doing is they ended up creating a whole generation of ghost hunters that were all using the exact same methodologies and the exact same tools. So instead of thinking for themselves and trying to figure out, you know, or coming up with their own theories on like what these things are or not, they were just basically just mimicking everything they saw on TV. So the result of that was, is you had scores of people bumping around in old houses, or, you know, across the nation and even the world, using the exact same tools, the exact same methodology. And so far, none of that has been proven to be effective in, you know, detecting any kind of paranormal phenomena. So what would have been better is if people had their own theories and their own methods, just so we can kind of do more of a scattershot of different approaches rather than everyone you take the same technique.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like you don't still love the spooky and the weird, Kevin. I know you love to book yourself into as many haunted hotels in North America as you possibly can. But it seems that you've gone away from a kind of gadget-based investigation to more of a kind of studious investigator where you would probably just take a notebook and speak with people rather than trying to sort of capture EVPs and paranormal activity on cameras or use the variety of wonderfully weird gadgets that seem to be available these days that we all see so often on virtually every TV show that indulges in ghost hunting these days.
That's absolutely correct. You know, I used to have a whole array of gear that I just don't even bring along anymore. Like these days, you know, because I don't really have anything to prove, or I'm not out to prove anything to other people necessarily. I want to experience something with my own eyes or see with my own ears. So when I go to places, I just pay attention more than anything. You know, I have a camera. Everyone has a camera on their phone, of course. But generally, I just like to sit and just be aware and just be present in some of these buildings. And I think a big part of it is just being at the right place at the right time. And so my whole goal is to be in these kinds of locations as much as possible, because obviously the more often I am, the more likely potentially something could happen. Because, you know, you always hear these stories about hauntings, and it's usually from people that own the houses because they're there all the time. Whereas like a ghost hunter going to a house is there for maybe a night or maybe a week or so, off and on. So the likelihood of something happening when they're there is very, very low. So I try to, whenever I stay at any hotel, I always make sure that it has some kind of strange history or that kind of thing. So the way I look at it is I'm just kind of narrowing it down and increasing the likelihood of that if there is something strange there, you know, maybe one of these days something will happen. And there's been some strange things that have happened here and there. I wouldn't definitively call them ghosts, but, you know, they're more of like head scratchers that I can't explain. So
I suppose as well, for somebody as studious and a lover of folklore and paranormal history as you are, Kevin, and every time we've spoken, you've always come across to me as someone that has a deep love of studying the strange more than anything else, as well as your fearless investigation, as we'll touch on later. But are you one of those people that will look at these certain haunted locations? As I said, you're still a frequent visitor to many a haunted location, regardless of the fact that it's not something that you're trying to capture more often than just go and experience the venue and the people and the stories around it. Do you plan your visits to certain locations where certain places will have a regular appearance, or there'll be certain times of year perhaps where certain notorious venues have an anniversary ghost, or something happens more often in the summer than the winter perhaps?
I do when I can. I've found that a lot of the places that I go to, the phenomena is fairly random. Not a whole lot of anniversary ghosts that I've run into in the past few years. But when that is the case, I definitely try to make sure that, you know, I'm there around that time. You know, sometimes it's like, oh, this happens at midnight, or this happens at 3 a.m. or something like that. And in those cases, I'll try to be around when those times occur. But in general, I just try to be present basically anytime, because you just never know when something odd is going to happen.
I think one of the most intriguing ghosts that I'm aware of, and I know you've been to this location and you've had something pretty odd happened when you were there, is the Mizpah Hotel in Nevada. Now, I'm aware of this for two reasons, because there seems to be a couple of these places in the US where there are hotels where guests will complain to the staff about the children making loads of noise. And they always get told, well, there's no children stopping here. We're not sure what's going on. And this is one of those locations. However, I suppose most people will know this particular location because of its most famous ghost, and probably the most famous ghost in Nevada, which is the Woman in Red.
Yeah, the Woman in Red is a real famous one. And I'll tell the story of what she is. So back around the turn of the century, there was a couple that was staying at the hotel, and the man had to go catch a train. I don't recall what his work was or where he needed to go, but he had left early in the morning to catch a train. And but he missed the train, or the train was late. There was some reason why he couldn't get on the train. And so he came back to the hotel only to find his wife in their bedroom with another man. And in a rage, he stabbed the woman. And to this day, these people say that they see this woman right around that room or that part of the hallway. And they call her the woman in red, or sometimes the lady in red, because, and it's not because she's wearing a red dress. She's actually usually reported wearing a white dress, but there's blood all down the front of the dress, which is why they call her the lady in red. And, you know, there's a tragedy there, but they think one of the theories is that it's sort of like a residual haunting, you know, that she keeps reliving this moment of her death, you know, where she collapsed. Here's her door by the hallway. So it's a really interesting one. And when I was there a few years ago, I was taking some pictures and just kind of chatting with some of the people in the hotel. Cause that's one of the first things I always do, is talk to the people that are on hand, you know, cause again, they're there all the time and I'm only there once or twice.
Hmm.
So I was talking to one of the custodial staff, a cleaning lady, and I asked her if she had any stories about the Lady in Red, or any other stories about the hotel. And at first she was kind of hesitant to talk to me about it, because some of these hotels, you know, like the Stanley Hotel, you know, they embrace their ghost lore, but a lot of hotels are kind of hesitant. You know, they don't want to scare people away. They don't want to spook people too much. But I kind of put her at ease, and I said, look, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I research. You know, I stay at haunted hotels all the time, but I'd really love to hear what kind of story you have. And so she basically told me that she has seen this woman in red on a number of occasions. And in fact, she ended up pulling out her phone and showing me a picture that she took. She'd taken it earlier in the year. And I looked at this picture and my jaw about hit the floor. It was one of the most amazing spiritual photographs that I've ever seen, at least being compelling, because she took a picture of the doorway to the room where the woman was murdered, kind of from across the hall, or kind of where the elevators are.
Hmm.
And you can plainly see a woman standing in that doorway area. I mean, not super distinct, like a really crisp photo, but like you can definitely tell it was human shape, probably female, but wearing white and just dark, dark stains all down the front of the dress, and just exactly where the people claim to see this ghost. And I was just floored by it, you know, and I said, you know, did you see this when you took the picture? And she said, yes, I did. She said, I saw it. I took the picture and I ran. So it was really compelling. I mean, is there a potential that she's, you know, hoaxing me? Sure. But I mean, this was like an older cleaning lady, housekeeper, that didn't really strike me as the kind of person that would just do that kind of thing. And like I said, she was hesitant to even talk about it in the first place. So that made me think that what she had there was something truly unusual.
Mm. Like you say, if she's so reticent to even discuss it, Kevin, it seems highly unlikely that she'll broach the subject and then go, oh, by the way, I've got this. Because clearly when you talk about these particular subjects, often people will have experiences, and I think a lot of people have been burnt by interviews or shows on television or other kinds of investigators that perhaps have misused the information and the experiences that are shared with them in a way that makes the witness feel diminished in some regards, that they're not important, or they're stupid, or they're just being silly. And yet, I find it very hard to believe that someone would be so loath to even discuss the subject and yet still have something to confirm both her own personal experiences and the fact that she has seen the alleged woman in red hanging around this haunted room.
Yeah, I mean, it made it a lot more believable to me, at least.
Mm. As you say, I mean, the thing about this hotel as well is that it's one of those that seems to have been saved from dilapidation, Kevin, from what I gather, and it seemed to have got really run down and has had a bit of a resurgence over the last sort of 10, 15 years, where some locals bought it and they've completely restored it back to its early 20th century grandeur, because it is an absolutely stunning building that they seem to have given a really sympathetic restoration to as well.
It's a beautiful structure. I mean, it's one of the most interesting buildings in town.
Do you think, as you say, obviously living in England, most haunted hotels here bang on and on and on about their ghosts, Kevin, and I'm still getting my head around why certain venues and hotels in the States, some are quite open about their ghosts and some they just don't want to talk about it, whereas this place seems to be very proud of the spirits that are wandering around this location. Is that the more you've done this and the more places you've gone, would you say a 50-50 split, or would you say more places don't like to promote it? It's kind of a whispered haunting.
That's a great question. When I first started doing this, I would say maybe 20% would like to talk about it, or 20%, you know, celebrated it. And now I would say it's definitely in the majority. I think it falls down to what type of business it is. If it's a very high-end hotel, they're less likely to talk about it. And if it's a very, very small bed and breakfast, you know, where their margins are much smaller, I think they're also a lot less likely to talk about it. But all of the places that are kind of in the middle, like medium-sized hotels and things like that, I think those are the ones that are more likely to talk about it. I don't know if it's just a risk factor that they're dealing with, but or just their clientele is a little bit different. But that they seem to be a lot more open to it. And in Chinopa, where the Mitsuko Hotel is, there's also another one too that embraces it. It's in the same town. It's you may have heard of this one. It's the Clown Motel.
Ah, yes.
So in the same town, and they also embrace their whole haunted thing. And then it's one of the creepiest hotels I've ever been to. I mean, for completely different reasons, but it's for your listeners, this is a motel that was built probably in the late 50s, early 60s by the look of it. And it's right next to a pioneer graveyard that looks like something out of an old Western. And I mean, it's right next to it, like just a couple feet. And every room in this hotel is decorated with clown pictures and clown themed everything. Right. And if you walk in the lobby, it's just wall to wall clown stuff, you know, and people that are phobic of clowns would just have an absolute nightmare at this place. But it has a long history of being haunted. And so I was in one of the rooms and I was taking pictures and the battery on my camera just went dead. So I went out to my car and got a backup battery that I had charged, went back in that room. This was one of the rooms that according to the staff was the most haunted or one of the most haunted, and started taking more pictures. And within just moments, not even a minute or two, that battery went dead. You know, I thought that was pretty interesting and compelling. I mean, a battery drain is one of those things that people talk about occurring at haunted locations. You know, was it a coincidence? Perhaps, but I did find that kind of interesting.
Yeah. I know you mentioned it earlier. The Stanley Hotel as well is one of those strange places, Kevin, because I think it's probably one of the most well-known haunted hotels in the US. But I think people have a very different vision of it because of the film The Shining, obviously, because King wrote the book after staying at the Stanley Hotel, which is a very weird dream as well. I've read him talk about this before, where he said that he had a dream that the fire hose attacked his son and ate him, which is very yeah. strange, a strange dream in the best of circumstances, and obviously was the inspiration for The Shining. But obviously, as anybody who loves horror films will know, the hotel in the film is not the hotel that we know as the real Stanley, because I think that the hotel they used for the exterior shots in the film's up in Oregon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the Timberline Lodge up in Oregon that they used for the exterior shots. And of course, all the interior shots were all soundstage.
Yeah, it was all filmed here in the UK. But I also like the fact that the real Stanley Hotel, has it built itself a maze there now in sort of honor of the film? Because I would imagine they got sick to death of people turning up and asking where the maze was.
Yeah, that could have been why they did it. When I was there last time, they had just planted the maze. So it's kind of small. I mean, it takes a while to grow a true hedge maze, obviously. But they do have it now, which is pretty cool. I mean, they've really embraced their whole Shining history there. One of the interesting things when I was staying there, I wanted to stay in room 237 because, you know, it has that tie in with the film and the everything. I think in the book it's 217, if I recall. But that room is always booked for obvious reasons. You know, it's the most popular room. And they said, well, we can put you in the one next to it. So I said, okay, that's fine. And then I was talking to one of the staff that does the ghost tours, and we were just kind of talking shop and talking paranormal stuff. And I kind of mentioned how I wish I could have got room 237, but I ended up in this other room. And he's like, wait, what room are you in? And I said, well, I'm in the one next door. And he's like, well, that's good for you, because he's like, actually, that room and 237 were originally just one room. And so technically you're staying in room 237. It's just as it was originally. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Extremely fortuitous as well. It's one of those often, I think, certain places, there will be rooms that become notorious to the outside world, Kevin. And then when you speak to the staff, they'll say, well, actually, this room's probably just as good. So it sounds like that was one of those circumstances. But regardless of The Shining, the hotel has such a wonderfully weird history as well. I remember reading about the story about, because there was a very strange accident that happened there, I think, where, I mean, we can laugh about it because incredibly, no one was seriously injured or killed even, where I think, was it the housekeeper was going round and she lit a candle or a lantern and there'd been a gas leak on the second floor and blown, and it blew up. And she fell through the floor and luckily only broke both her ankles, but she survived a gas explosion with no major injuries other than the fact that she'd fallen a floor.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if that's where Stephen King got the whole boiler explosion idea for the book.
That's a good point. So other than the rooms that we've talked about, there are other aspects of the hotel. There is this strange concept of the vortex, which I believe is on the staircase, isn't it?
The staircase, the main staircase, that is where a lot of people claim to see paranormal phenomena, see apparitions, that kind of thing. I mean, just this week on Facebook, I don't know who posted it, but someone posted some new image of a figure that they caught on that staircase. It's centrally located in the middle of the hotel. So if you walk in, it's kind of one of the first things you see. And there's a whole theory behind that. So the hotel is built on the side of a mountain, and most of the rock beneath the hotel is quartzite. And some people believe that quartzite has this ability to sort of generate, well, I mean, we know that it generates energy. That's how a quartz watch works. But some people believe that that energy also applies to the paranormal world, that it somehow serves as like a fuel to make these things visible or to make them audible. And what's interesting about the hotel is it's kind of straddling two humps of the hill, like two very large mounds that are on the side of the mountain. And each one is on either side of the hotel. And so some people theorize that what it's doing is it's sort of creating like a circuit, like a positive and negative circuit, where energy is being transferred between those two nodes of the mountain and going up to the third floor and then back down and, you know, and then grounding itself in the earth. And some people think that that's why the third floor in particular has a lot of phenomena associated with it. Again, this is all just a theory, but, you know, it's one of those more interesting ones, I think.
Mm. I always like the stories about the concert room or the concert hall as well, because there are certain aspects of the paranormal and haunting, Kevin, that always sort of prick my interest more than, say, just a normal residual haunting or things being moved around and furniture and the like. And whenever somebody talks about ghostly music being heard or something similar, I'm always... They are the kind of stories that fascinate me, because that takes the whole concept of ghosts and hauntings to a different level, because then we're talking about music or sounds that make us question where on earth does this all fit in? And I think the Stanleys got very famous reports of this kind of thing being witnessed by lots of people.
You know, the music is a great thing to bring up, because it's like, are these sort of, it was like the stone tape theory. Are these recordings from the past that are somehow caught in the very walls and floors of a structure, sort of like grooves in a record. And then when conditions are right, they're replaying. You know, is that what we're experiencing, or are we experiencing just sort of like the malleability of time itself, seeing or hearing in this case, musical notes from the past that, you know, may have been played in that room? I think it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you've come across a lot when you've gone on your adventures into these hotels? Because as we said earlier, Kevin, you love to go and book yourself into many a haunted hotel. Is this something that turns up fairly frequently, or is the incidents that go on at the Stanley quite unique in the fact that people are hearing music being played?
Well, as far as sounds go, I would say that it's probably the most common type of phenomena, at least in my experience. And from what I've talked to other people, it seems to be more common than actual visual phenomena, you know, whether it's music or just sounds. And I think the Stanley has so much because it's famous for being haunted. You people that are staying there are kind of already aware of it and kind of watching with, you know, or even trying to, or sleeping with one eye open kind of thing. So people are kind of prepped for it. They're looking for it. Whereas at a hotel that may not be quite so famous or may not even have known haunted legends, people might not just be quite attuned to that. You know, it might be happening, but they're just not looking for it as intensely as people are at Stanley. So that could account for why there's more. Again, it could just be that there's something unique about the Stanley too. Some of the places that I've stayed at, I've had some weird things happen where there's a hotel here in Wisconsin that I stay at every Halloween night, and usually the night before Halloween too, because on that night, I'm usually there alone. And the owners leave the premises at night. And a couple of years ago when I was there, I heard a distinct sound of someone sighing in around the corner from the room I was in. And I went out there and I looked, didn't see anyone. And then I went back to my reading. And then about half an hour later, same thing happened. Like someone was like letting out some breath or like a sigh, like right out in the room. Never did figure out what that was. The place has a history of being haunted. It goes back to the 1830s or late 1820s. And then another year that I was there the night before Halloween, again, I'm only one in this whole hotel alone. And at about 3 a.m, one of the doors on my floor of the hotel just slammed. I mean, just really slammed, more than what would happen if it was like a draft or something making a door close. I mean, it was enough to make me bolt up in bed and take notice. And then of course I looked out in the parking lot to see if anyone had arrived or something, but I was still the only one there. So, but you know, gave me a little bit of a fright, but you know, it happens.
Yeah. Do you have any other particular favorites, Kevin, or do you think there are certain hotels that often, as we've talked about, two of the most famous examples in the US, do you think there are other locations where there are more phenomenon or more regular phenomenon that simply aren't as well known for whatever reason? Because often this is the other thing. It's all to do with how a story gets famous. As the two that we've mentioned, the Mizpah and the Stanley, obviously are very famous. The Mizpah seemed to be very famous due to the fact it often got mentioned on the Art Bell show in the 90s. And I think that, where its reputation, I think it was on Sightings as well, and that tended to help it. And obviously the Stanley's got the connection with the film and the book. Is there anywhere else that you've been recently or that you regularly go to, like the one you've just mentioned in Wisconsin, that is consistently spooky?
I mean, there's so many. I'm trying to narrow it down here. You know, I mean, a lot of haunted hotels, like if they look like they should be haunted, they're usually kind of popular. Like, you know, if a place looks spooky, they get popular. But, you know, honestly, one of my favorite places to stay, and maybe this is just because, you know, I live near the Great Lakes, but there's a lot of haunted lighthouses that you can stay at. And these are old, you know, 19th century lighthouses. And around Lake Superior, for instance, there's at least 3, maybe 4 different ones you can stay at just around that lake itself. And I've been at all of them, at least the ones that you can stay at. I mean, the other ones are publicly or privately owned. I mean, and there's just something about lighthouses that are very peculiar, that they have a whole atmosphere about them that is just, it's they're kind of romanticized and they're just strange. Yeah. And they also seem to attract a lot of misfortune because you have these people staying at, you know, back when they were operational. You have these lighthouse keepers that were staying there, sometimes alone. You know, sometimes they would go crazy from the solitude. And so you have these weird tragedies and things. So one of the lighthouses I was staying at was known for being haunted by one of the previous lighthouse keepers that lived there that had hanged himself. And no one really knows why he did it, but, you know, it's again, one of those tragedies. Maybe it was just, you know, the solitude, the isolation got to him, who knows. But when I was staying there, I was there three nights that year. And, you know, the whole place has kind of a eerie vibe, but, you know, I like eerie vibes. So that's why I do this kind of thing. But as I was leaving, you know, I was checking out of my room and I had my backpack around my shoulder and I was kind of walking out of my room backwards, just kind of scanning the room, making sure I didn't leave anything behind. And then out of the corner of my eye, to my left, I saw like a person like standing right behind me as I was, you know, backing into the hallway. And I could make out that the person was taller than I am, that they were male, that they had blue pants and a green top. And I kind of turned quickly, like to, you know, to apologize. So like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to back into you. And there was no one there. There was no doorways, like nothing else that a person could have just ducked into. But like, I could have swore there was someone right behind me that I was about to bump into as I was backing out of my room, and then they were gone. So what, you know, was that the lighthouse keeper? I can't say, but it was peculiar. I'll say that.
Yeah. There is something strange about lighthouses. As you say, Kevin, I don't know what it is. I mean, obviously when they were first built, a lot of them were in quite remote places. The people, as you say there, when you would go there, would tend to be on their own, or they may have an assistant. Some people would just have their families there, but they would be sort of away from everywhere because they were outside of towns and villages that they'd been built to service, as it were. So there is something odd about them. There seems to be, as buildings go, I think there's something quite emotive about lighthouses, and a lot of them are very beautiful. I know, especially in the US, there are some beautiful variations on what a lighthouse should be, because I think most people, when you mention lighthouses, they have a picture in their mind of a tall building with a light chamber on the top. Whereas across the US, I've seen a couple of documentaries about haunted lighthouses around the country. Some of them are so beautifully varied and all shapes and sizes and all kinds of colours. They are a beautiful thing in their own, regardless of any sort of paranormal history attached to them.
I agree 100%. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I loved staying at them. Whenever I have the opportunity, there's something about lighthouses that are just so mysterious to me. You know, whether it's that whole like liminal sense, you know, they're kind of perched upon that boundary between, you know, solid land and water, you know, sort of that liminal zone where anything's possible, or you know, between here and there, sort of like bridges are the same way, but you know, they're always on the precipice of two different kinds of worlds.
Is it something, I know that it seems to have been one of those aspects of the paranormal that haunted lighthouses seem to be quite a niche subject. I know, as you've mentioned there, you've certainly mentioned your trips to them in past discussions I've heard you have, Kevin. And I know David Weatherly's obviously done a book about haunted lighthouses as well. Whereas here in the UK, I can probably think of two or three that have got any kind of sort of haunted legends attached to them. Obviously, the most famous one over here is the Flannan Lighthouse, but that's more to do with the fact that everybody vanished from it one particular day and nobody's ever got to the bottom of what happened to them. Lots of people have put forward theories about it, from giant sea monsters to UFOs to freak waves, Kevin. There's no real kind of accepted explanation, though there is also the fact that the locals viewed the area as sacred, and there was a connection with the Fae in that particular area, and therefore they believed that the people went because the people that, or the creatures that existed there, were not very happy that humans had decided to throw up a great big building on their land.
That's fascinating.
Hmm. So in regards to when you're continuing your travels around the country, I know that you always had a deep love in folklore and preserving some of these stories that may have been in danger of disappearing. And I think when we talk about folklore and urban legends and stories about haunted buildings and the like, I used to be very churlish about folklore, Kevin, about 4 or 5 years ago. I used to, you know, not really pay much heed. And yet now I find myself sort of chastising myself for being so negative and closed-minded about it, because now I've suddenly realized what a wonderful world I'd kind of shut myself off from. And I know as you've continued to develop your love of this subject, you've kind of moved away into a variety of topics. So as we were saying about your sort of early introduction into it and the fact that you were just attracted to the weird, was there something from the aspects of folklore that began to pull you in, Kevin, or was that something that you were just kept coming across whilst you were doing paranormal investigation?
I think that it is, again, something that just I kept encountering over and over. And like you, you know, early on, you know, I put two things in two buckets. You know, either there was like paranormal places, like haunted houses and things that were seen as more important. And then there was other stuff that fell more into the category of just tall tales, you know, which I thought were interesting, but I didn't put a whole lot of focus on them in the beginning. But, you know, over the years, and as I did more research, I started seeing how the two are linked more than I had previously thought. And then I started just kind of seeing the beauty in some of these tall tales too, you know, which ones are true and which ones aren't. You know, again, it becomes kind of irrelevant because, and especially in some of these small towns and things, you know, it becomes part of the local character, part of their local lore and what they're proud of and what they celebrate. So even if it's demonstrably, you know, not true, it still has an impact on how people live and how they view themselves, and it colors the whole region.
Have you come across certain themes? Because often when we talk about certain legends and certain urban myths, Kevin, often, especially when you've got a country as large as the US, there is a real sort of correlation between certain places which are hundreds of miles apart and they have almost the identical story. Is that something that, as a lover of legends and folklore, Kevin, makes you scratch your head and wonder how two places so far apart have very similar stories? Or do you just think that that's part of the human need and our love of stories and legends that's allowed certain things to pop up in more than one location?
You know, that's been studied quite a bit. There's a book out that where they studied just the Phantom Hitchhiker legend. You probably have similar legends in the UK too, where, you know, the whole Phantom Hitchhiker story, you can find it all over the country. I mean, it's everywhere. There's one that's just a few miles from where I am right now. You know, like people have these haunted hitchhiker stories all over the place. And so is it something that's just kind of in our deep within our psyche that you know, comes out in every region? Or is it something that was more transmitted word of mouth, you know, just as storytelling does, and just kind of moved it way across the nation? It's hard to say. You could say the same thing with, you know, like the Lover's Lane Hookman legends, you know, like those are extremely common. And, you know, there are a whole number of things. Or another one would be like the Gravity Hills. In the US here, we have what are called Gravity Hills, where if you park your car on this hill and turn off your engine, that your car will start rolling uphill. And usually the part of the story is that if you put baking soda or flour on the back of your car, that you'll see like little handprints that were allegedly pushing your car. And, you know, a lot of these places that have been researched, they usually end up being optical illusions. You know, what looks like you're going uphill is actually downhill. There's something about the terrain that gives the appearance of being uphill when it's not. But it's just really fascinating how similar all these stories are. You know, you can find them all over the place.
That one I'm very aware of. I know at least of 5 different versions of that particular story, Kevin, in the US and Canada as well. I've heard of one in Canada and 4 in the US. And once again, as you say, it's all down to false perspective. But it's very odd how this backstory is created to sort of explain what's going on and like you say, putting flour or baking soda on the back of the car so you can see the handprints. And I've heard two versions of this story where it involves a bus full of children being killed by a train.
Yes, I have too.
And also I've heard that there's usually some kind of tragic accident, and the reason your car moves is that these people are trying to get you out of the way of danger. Is that something that seems to be the general sort of origin story for all of these, Kevin? Or when you've looked at them with these Gravity Hills, is there any real variation to that? Because the majority of the ones I've read about or seen people discussing or talking about, there seems to be some kind of tragic accident that's created this situation for people in their car.
I would say that the vast majority of the ones that I've looked at have that exact story or backstory, is with the bus and the children being struck on the bus on a rail line kind of thing. There's been a couple that don't have any explanation, and maybe that's because they're just kind of out in the middle of nowhere without train tracks anywhere near. But one of the things that really surprises me is like how these are discovered, because it is a weird phenomena. You know, like when it happens, you swear that you're going uphill. Like it feels like you're going uphill. And so I always wonder like how people discover these, or maybe they're all over the place and it's just kind of, you know, luck that people just happen to discover, you know, turn their car off at that spot and put it in neutral and it just started rolling. You know, it's just so strange how all these things can be so pervasive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As one of the topics I wanted to sort of pick your brains on, Kevin, as I was saying about my knowledge increasing over the duration of doing this show and speaking with people like yourself from across the world, I have to say I was very, very surprised when I discovered that the US has a history of hellhounds and black dogs, because I think if you talk about the paranormal and this particular subject comes up, everybody thinks it just happens here, which I now know is palpable nonsense. It's simply not true. They happen all over the world. But I know you were a recent featured speaker at the Van Meter Festival, and you gave a presentation on this particular subject, Kevin. So was this something that when you sort of came across one of these stories, you were quite surprised about, or with your love of this particular facet of the paranormal and your deep interest in folklore from around the continent, was it something that just didn't surprise you and you thought, well, why not? We seem to have everything else going on here.
Yeah, it's kind of the latter. I guess I wasn't too surprised because there's a hellhound story that's not too far from where I live. So I kind of grew up knowing that these did occur in the States too. But I was well aware of you know, how the origins of hellhounds and phantom black dogs and things like that being, you know, primarily, at least in, you know, English speaking world, you know, from the UK. So it was one of those things that's always kind of fascinated me. In fact, it's the topic of my next book that I'm working on. And what's interesting about it the most to me, I guess, is how the legends have adapted in the New World. Like I'm very familiar with a lot of the ones from the British Isles, and they're all super cool. But, and so you think that, well, it's the same story only set in Nebraska, or the same story but set in Missouri or something. But what I found is that the American ones are a little bit different. They have different properties. They have different reasons for showing up, and they've sort of adapted to the American climate here in a really unique way. And I'll give you an example. So in America, black dogs have become part of trucker lore. You know, like semi drivers across the states believe that if you're driving, you're like doing a long haul and you're driving at night and you're driving longer than you should be safely because you've been on the road for 13 hours or something and you're tired. They believe that it's this legend among truckers that a black dog will appear in the middle of the road, and that's a warning that you need to pull over, that it's no longer safe to drive, that you're too tired, and you should find a rest stop and continue your journey later. However, if it's not heeded, then something bad will happen, you know, whether you'll fall asleep at the wheel and jackknife the semi, or perhaps run into another car, or, you know, go off the edge of some area or something. So they believe that it's this warning, this sort of, I don't want to say it's doom, but it's symbolic of potential doom. So if you see it, you know, they're like, okay, pull over. It's time to take a break. So it's just interesting to me how that the black dog legend has worked its way into something like trucker lore. There's even a movie about it that has Patrick Swayze in it called Black Dog, where he's a long haul trucker. And he sees the black dog and doesn't heed its warning. And then tragedy happens.
How strange. That is very unusual when it comes to what the perception of what the black dog legend is, Kevin. Have you been able to kind of pinpoint when that started? Or is this something that's just been embraced by truckers all across the US? And therefore, it's one of those things that if you're a trucker and a long haul one at that, then everybody knows about this. Or is it? I mean, I've never really heard that before.
It's widely known among truckers, and honestly, that's part of my research right now that I'm trying to figure out. I've heard both things. Some truckers claim that it's been around for as long as trucking, you know, maybe even longer, you know, when it was horse and carriage, who knows? They claim that it's always been around, but then I've talked to other truckers that seem to indicate that it's more of a modern interpretation or a modern phenomena. So it's, again, that's part of my research right now, trying to definitively see if there is some kind of origin to where this started.
Do you have situations over there where you've got a particular area where they've got two versions of this particular phenomenon, Kevin? Because sometimes there are, one of the weird things about the UK version is it depends whereabouts in the country you are on how they view these creatures. Certain places view them as an omen of good luck or a protector, and others view them as a sign of impending doom or misfortune occurring. Is that something that occurs in America, or is it one of those where it could even change from state to state depending on where this particular story originates from?
There's definitely a variation from region. I would say as far as the trucker story goes, those are pretty consistent among truckers. But as far as just general black dog legends, they're pretty varied. You know, there's some that are like the classic church grim, where they protect graveyards. And so if you're in a graveyard at night when you shouldn't be, or you're vandalizing or doing something is seen as being disrespecting the dead, then this dog will come out and chase you. There's one out east in North Carolina that is known. It's called the demon dog of Valley Crucis, that chases people out of a graveyard. And then if you head down the road, the only thing that stops it from chasing you is by crossing this bridge after you go over the running water and it can't follow you any further. So there is that, you know, like the classic kind of church grim black dog. Of course, you also have more hellhound type legends too, like the classic Robert Johnson legend, you know, where he allegedly sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. And then after then, he had a hellhound on his trail. I mean, that's why he wrote that legendary Delta Blues song, Hellhound on My Trail. So there is a variety of stories depending on where you go. And if we're not limiting ourselves just to the United States and more just the Americas in general, in Central America, they believe in what are called cadejos, which are basically like hellhounds or phantom black dogs, only they show up in, there's usually a black one or a white one. And if the white one shows up, it's not seen as good luck per se, but it's not seen as dangerous. It's more of like a warning. However, there's also a black one, and if the black one shows up, usually you're never seen again. So it's really interesting how the legends are around the country. And then also black dogs over here, and I know they are in the UK too, they're often associated with shapeshifting. Usually there's some kind of shapeshifting ghost. So for instance, in my area here in Wisconsin, not too far from here, there's a legend of what's called the Ridgeway ghost. It's this ghost that haunts this ridge that used to be an old wagon trail back in the 1800s. And sometimes it will appear as a man. Sometimes it will appear as a black dog with green glowing eyes that will chase you. So that's a fairly common one too, is sort of these sort of shape shifting ghosts. And then, in more of the southern region of the country, there's a belief, kind of, this is the Gullah region down by, South Carolina and Georgia area. And they believe down there in a creature or a supernatural creature that's called a plat eye. And that is usually some form of malevolent ghost that often takes the form of a black dog. Not always. Sometimes it's a person. But the way that you identify it is there's usually something off about it. Like if it's a person, they're like missing an eye, or they're missing an ear, maybe even missing a hand. Or if it's a dog, it might be, missing a leg, or it might even have, in some more gruesome ones that I've read about, it's like a dog that's dragging its entrails, you know, but doesn't seem worried by it, kind of thing. So there's always something that kind of tips you off that this isn't a normal dog, kind of thing. And that's usually seen as a bad omen.
That would certainly put the heebie-jeebies up anybody, I think, Kevin, if you came across anything like that. And there is that kind of aspect to some of them that often, when you talk about these particular legends or these encounters, sometimes people will just not consider it to be strange or unusual, especially in the US and Canada, because at the end of the day, you're talking about a continent with a large wolf population, Kevin. So I would imagine that in some reports, people at first aren't overly concerned because they just think it's something fairly normal. And it's only when something strange happens or the creature begins to behave in a certain way that makes you think, this just doesn't seem right. Do you find that you still get the reports of these creatures having flaming eyes or being able to travel at excessive speeds, or they're able to sort of just constantly keep appearing, as we get often over here, it's the behavior of the creature that makes people realize something strange is going on?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. It usually is the behavior of the creature, or, and sometimes how it appears. There's a hellhound legend in my area, and again another one that's called the Hellhounds of Mary Dean. And Mary Dean is this, it's a ghost town that used to be on an island within the Eau Claire River in Wisconsin. And according to legend, on this island, there's this pack, I think it's usually two black dogs that haunt the island. And they even haunt the boat launch that goes over to the island too. And one of my co-authors, Chad, he was talking to a guy at one of his talks, saying that, you know, that I think two or three of them, they were on a motorcycle. And these black dogs just came out of the woods and started chasing them. And these are big dogs. And so, of course, they got out of there not wanting to get bit or mauled. And so they took off on their motorcycles and the dogs chased after them. And they kept going faster and faster and faster. But the dogs were keeping pace. And according to this witness, he looked down at his speedometer and he was going about 55 miles an hour. And yet this dog was still, you know, hounding him. And so he decided to kick out at the dog to make it go away. And when he did so, his foot went right through the dog as if there was nothing there, like it was just smoke. And I've heard that story over and over in many different forms on how when people are being chased by these things, they're matching some kind of unnatural speed. And then, you know, they hit them with something or they kick them with something and it just goes right through them. So it's not the first time I've heard that.
How peculiar. I mean, that alone, I think if you're doing over 50 miles an hour on a motorcycle, Kevin, and something's keeping up with you, you know you're in trouble, whatever's happening.
Exactly.
So I'm always, one of my favorite ones that I'm aware of, and I'm sure you've uncovered this, is this strange story about the black dog of Lake Erie and its alleged connection with shipping disasters. And it's one of those that it seems a rather peculiar thing, because why would you associate a black dog with a ship? It seems an unusual connection for me. Is this something that you've seen in other stories that you've uncovered where these creatures are seen in areas or connected with things that you wouldn't normally associate a dog being around, as it were?
Well, I mean, the one that you brought up, that one's a really interesting one because it's almost, again, it's sort of this death omen kind of thing. And from all the reports I've read of that particular one, the dog isn't even all that particular scary. You know, it's not this big wolfish looking dog. It's just a normal black dog. And, you know, not even being all that, ferocious or anything, but just its very presence is like this indicator that something bad is going to happen. I was just trying to think of another one that is similar to that. There's a few graveyard dog ghosts. There's one out east where a dog refused, the owner died, and the dog refused to leave the grave of the person after they died, and it would always hang out and sleep at the grave. And then even after the dog passed away, people claim that this black dog still sits at the grave, that you can see it now and then, the ghost of the dog.
How strange. That's weird as well, because obviously there's a very famous story here in the UK of Greyfriars Bobby, which is a story about a dog that did exactly that for years. Kevin, I think it's in Edinburgh. Sure, it's in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and there's a statue to it and everything. So when you look at these stories like the Black Dog of Lake Erie, I think it's the fact that, I don't know why, you just don't associate dogs with ships. I don't know, maybe that's my ignorance, Kevin. I would always presume cats would be on ships for the rats more than anything. But that's not to say a dog can keep your ship clear of rats either, depending on what breed it is. Have you come across anything else weird or any of these stories where you're thinking, well, this doesn't really seem to make much sense?
Well, one that's really bizarre that goes way back is actually a Native American black dog tale. And this one is out in Georgia. There's a place in Georgia that's called, the native word for it is Nodorock. And it's this swampy area that is full of this kind of bluish gray mud. And there's a lot of like quicksand and things like that. And there's a lot of peat bogs and things. But anyway, back in the 1700s and earlier, this was always bubbling because of all the methane gas that would come out. And then when lightning strikes would happen, this swamp area would start on fire. And so because of that, the Native Americans believed that it was this gateway to the underworld, because you've got this flaming mud that's like bubbling all the time and stuff. In fact, they said that in the center of this swamp was like a mud volcano where the methane would build up, and then occasionally they would have blasts. And so they believe that this was an entrance to the underworld, and that's the basic translation of what Nodorock is. And when they had criminals within their tribes, they would execute them by throwing them into this terrible place, into the mud and everything. And they believed that in that swamp, there was this creature that they called the Wog, that's W-O-G, that was sort of like a hellhound, but it had a forked tongue, and it was the size of a wolf, but had a large head more like a bear. But they believed that it was this infernal beast that would devour the corpses of these executed criminals. And there's some really interesting colonial accounts of this area too, and like how they described it. And you know, everyone mostly kind of avoided it because it was just a nasty place. But I was there earlier this year, back in there. It's not as vast as it used to be because people have drained the swamp some, but it's still there to this day, and it's a very, very weird place. And so I think that's one of the sort of hellhound or demonic dog stories that I like a lot, just because it has the history that goes so far back.
I mean, to be fair, that doesn't sound like the kind of place you'd want to go hellhound or not, Kevin, to be fair. If you've got sort of red hot molten mud flying everywhere.
Yeah, when I was there, I don't know if there's left methane these days or not, but like it was still There was a lot of areas where you had to really be careful where you walked. I mean, it would look like solid ground, but then when you stepped on it, you know, you would just go down into deep muck, you know, up to your waist or worse. It's a really weird area of it. But I mean, according to some of the old accounts, that Baven had some kind of stone altar near the edge of this swamp back in the 1700s, but then it was dismantled by colonists, unfortunately. But it's a really interesting legend.
Yeah. Is it as well? I suppose one of the difficulties you have when you're looking at stories like this, Kevin, I would imagine is there's a lot of things, especially in the modern era, where old legends and folklore have started to become adapted and changed into modern monsters, or people have decided that these old stories must be a particular type of cryptid. I'm thinking primarily of skinwalkers and dogmen. Is that something that you've noticed tends to happen with some of these legends, where people have begun to adapt them into their particular version of what's going on? Or is there still this kind of separation between hellhounds and black dogs being kept as these particular legends, rather than becoming what we now see in modern cryptozoology and certain stories that go on?
So I think it really depends on who you talk to. If you talk to some of the more serious cryptozoologists that are more flesh and blood type researchers, you know, some of these guys and ladies, you know, that don't believe in the supernatural at all. You know, that's just not where their research goes. You know, they believe that they're looking for things that are true animals that are just unknown, or maybe we thought were extinct, but are quite extinct. And, you know, so a lot of Bigfoot hunters fall under this category. Those researchers believe that Bigfoot is a flesh and blood creature, just a some kind of hominid that's never been discovered. But other people tend to think that these things are a much more bizarre phenomena than just undiscovered animals. They think that it's more in the realm of perhaps being some kind of transdimensional phenomena or supernatural, depending on what person's preference of terminology is there. So there's kind of two camps. I don't really make a judgment call on whether one's right or one's wrong, but like, my personal philosophy is I tend to lean more towards things being a little on the stranger side, just because I think that some of these things that happen or these creatures that are described are just too fantastical to be just a normal flesh and blood creature. So if they do exist, I think that they're just something that's of a different order of existence that we're just not familiar with. So it really just depends on who you're talking to and how they define cryptid. And I think the term cryptid has become sort of a catch-all for any kind of monster, you know, which isn't the greatest thing, because it's not real helpful if you're truly looking for just flesh and blood animals. You know, having everything fall under the cryptid category, whether it's ivory-billed woodpecker that's supposed to be extinct, but yet people see it. I mean, that's a whole different category than, say, a lake monster, you know? So
yes, it is a difficult subject once you open your arms to what comes under the banner of the term cryptid. I think of that, there's no doubt. But I'm fascinated by these, because like I say, I have to say that the vast majority of black dog stories, especially here in the UK, tend to lean well into the supernatural without any shadow of a doubt, because of the way the creatures behave. As you've mentioned there, one of the other facets that often gets brought up is by going over running water to avoid them or to get away from them. So I find that very interesting, that it's still something that occurs even in versions of these encounters and stories in North America, that you've still got these aspects of it, like rather crossing over running water and the black dog can't follow you for some reason.
Yeah, I would agree. You wonder if it's something that's within our collective unconscious, where like when these rules are established, if they just kind of carry over with them, and you know, if we sort of or transplanted these stories into the new world and kind of kept all the details with them, either consciously or unconsciously. And one of the things that I did find interesting in the research of this book, this kind of ties into that a little bit, is when I was kind of plotting out where these stories were located, the vast majority of them are located in kind of mountainous areas. So you have a lot of stories throughout Appalachia. You have stories in the Ozarks and places like that. And so, you know, one could immediately say, oh, well, there must be some connection between, like, you know, mountains and hills and black dogs. But at the same time, these two regions were also settled by a lot of Scotch-Irish people. So were they bringing their stories with them, you know, from the UK and then transplanting them into the new world? Is that why we have more stories in those areas, because of just the descendants that that colonized those areas? Or is it something that's just about the environment itself? It's hard to say.
Yeah, I think there will be some kind of aspect of that, and you would suspect that. However, once again, when you look at it, the Shook or the Black Dog, the majority of the stories are from England, and they're not from Scotland and Ireland, Kevin. So that itself is an extremely odd aspect to it, that why would they adapt a mostly English history of folklore to those particular regions? That's a very interesting point. I never thought of that correlation. That's even weirder.
It is. I mean, there's a fair amount of English within those regions too. I mean, they were in those areas before the Scotch-Irish, but then the Scotch-Irish came in a later migrant wave and tended to stay, whereas the English kind of kept moving on.
Probably scared of the black dogs, Kevin. That's why they went. So when you've been doing your research, often here in the UK, we have books that were written 40, 50 years ago about this particular subject. It's very overlooked in English 14 literature, this particular subject. There's probably three or four, and they're probably as rare as a black dog sighting, Kevin, these days, to try and get hold of copies. Is this something that is a subject that hasn't really been explored fully in American folklore, or is it something that perhaps somebody wrote about 50, 60, 70 years ago? As you mentioned, Robert Johnson. Yeah, that's nearly 100 years ago now since Johnson's career reached its nadir. So was it something that was quite well known at that period of time and has kind of drifted away over the years? Or is it something that, as I mentioned there, you've had occasional authors and investigators over the last 100 years that have dove into this subject, and unfortunately nobody's carried on the work till now?
Well, my impression is that, at least in America, it's not a very well-known phenomena. I mean, people's most of their contact with it would be through pop culture, at least in the United States. You know, you see hellhounds in movies or TV shows, or like supernatural-themed TV shows and things like that. So I think that's where most people are getting their information from, or at least being aware of it these days. But there really hasn't been much written about them at all in the United States, at least as far as specifically like the stories that are located here. And there's plenty of books on black dogs and phantom hounds in the British Isles, but there aren't any that are about the specifically American tales. There might be a chapter here and a chapter there in various books on very particular stories that are more region specific, but. And that's partly why I'm writing this book, is my goal is to basically cover just American tales of these creatures, because I find them so unique and distinct, you know, kind of like the trucker stories I was alluding to earlier.
So is it one of those aspects of the paranormal, Kevin, that you've been surprised at its reach, that you'll be able to uncover a story in Oregon as well as Arizona, or from New England as well as California? It's something that seems to be all over the states, or as you mentioned there about the particular mountainous regions, are there more hot spots and it's not as widespread?
I would say, again, the mountainous regions have the most, but they're everywhere. I mean, there's black dog ones in California, in the Southwest. There's a black dog legend in Hawaii, and that falls under one of the shapeshifter ones. It's known as like this kind of cannibal dog that's like a fearsome hellhound that goes back to native Hawaiian lore. But they're everywhere. I mean, everywhere I've gone, it's so strange. Like, there's always stories of these phantom black dogs. And I mean, I'd say most of them, maybe I'd say over half, are linked to graveyards. There's a lot of black dogs haunting graveyard stories. Secondly would probably be like old country lanes. But you know, you just never know. There's all kinds of different ones that and very unique ones depending on the region.
I think what I can learn from that, Kevin, is don't build a truck stop next to a graveyard then.
Right.
So when are you hoping to have the book out, Kevin? Because it sounds a fascinating subject, and I wasn't aware it was that widespread. I knew there was a few little pockets here and there, but I didn't, like I say, the trucker's stories really flabbergasted me because I'd never heard of that before.
Well, so far, if I keep on track here without getting too distracted, that's my own enemy here. I'm hoping to have the book out sometime next year. We'll see how that goes. But, you know, it's one of those things where you think you've got it wrapped up, and then all of a sudden you find this whole new avenue of research that you just need to get in the book. So,
fingers crossed, because I'm looking forward to it after everything you've told me about. So, Kevin, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you in full. Where can everybody follow your work, follow the other books that you've co-authored, and keep up to date with what you've got going on, my friend?
Well, a lot of the work that I do along with my co-authors, you can find at backroadslore.com. You can also follow me on Facebook. I'm constantly traveling the nation and checking out different legends everywhere. I'm always posting stories on there. So those are probably the best two places.
Fabulous. Well, Kevin, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you in full and dive into this. Like I say, I'm really looking forward to this new book. I can't wait to see how many more strange stories and legends you uncover during this investigation. And just want to say thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure, Kevin.
It was great to be on. Thanks for having me again.